You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Donald Trump's campaign chairman went to jail. So did his personal lawyer. His longtime political consigliere was convicted of serious federal crimes, and his national security advisor pled guilty to others. Several Russian spies were indicted in absentia. Career intelligence agents and military officers were alarmed enough by the president's actions that they alerted senior government officials and ignited the impeachment process. Yet despite all of this, a years-long inquiry led by special counsel Robert Mueller and the third impeachment of a president in American history, Donald Trump survived to run for re-election. Why? CNN chief legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin attempts to answer that question in a highly entertaining, definitive account of the Mueller investigation and the impeachment titled True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. And today, Jeff returns to the podcast to discuss why this was the hardest book that he's ever written and how he managed to gain access to a number of Robert Mueller's lead investigators, including a few of those so-called angry Democrats. He reveals why Mueller declined to subpoena Donald Trump, why he never attempted to get a hold of Trump's financial records, and why he ultimately stopped just short of saying that the president had committed the crime of obstruction. He describes Mueller and Trump as not a story of good versus bad as much as old versus new, and he explains how Mueller's integrity and restraint may have been his greatest weakness, and how Trump's all-star team of lawyers managed to outfox the investigation by dominating the narrative in the media. Plus, Jeff gives a damning assessment of Bill Barr's conduct as Attorney General, questions whether Trump will be out of legal jeopardy once he's out of the White House, and speculates on what might happen if a Supreme Court vacancy opens up between Election Day and the inauguration. Coming up with CNN chief legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin in just a moment. Jeffrey Toobin is chief legal analyst at CNN and a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is the author of several best-selling books, including American Heiress, The Oath, The Nine, and The Run of His Life, which was the basis for the FX limited series American Crime Story, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. A Vast Conspiracy, his book about the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, is also slated for a new installment of American Crime Story next year. And now he's out with his latest book, and I'm told he's already got a TV or a film deal for that one, too. It's called True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Jeffrey Toobin, welcome back to the podcast.
It's good to be with you.
Well, Jeffrey, last time we talked about your book about the Patty Hearst kidnapping, and now you're writing about something much fresher in the public's mind and way more fraught with political controversy. I've actually heard you say that this was the hardest book that you've ever written. What made it so difficult?
No question, it was the hardest. It was a moving target. I agreed to write this book more or less as soon as Mueller was appointed in May of 2017, and it was supposed to be basically a Mueller book. I quickly found out that it was impossible to get any access to Mueller and his team while he was working. So that was extremely unnerving in the first place. But then, of course, the story evolved from simply the Mueller investigation to Ukraine and the impeachment investigation, which, of course, I had no idea was going to happen when I started work on it. So I obviously wanted to get this book out before the election. So it involved a lot of working, you know, trying to do the reporting and writing at more or less the same time. And then you layer on top of that the pandemic, which in some respects was, I mean, I don't mean to make light of anything, but, you know, by confining me to home, it certainly forced me to write and meet my deadlines. But it also, you know, limited some of my reporting options because I'm someone who likes to go see people in person, not just talk to people on the phone. So all of that meant that it was just a very difficult project, especially compared to Patty Hearst, which was really sort of at the borderline of history and journalism. Those people were not used to being called on the phone, and they were all basically happy to talk about, you know, what was in many respects the most interesting thing they'd ever been involved with.
And now Robert Mueller's team was famously tight-lipped during the investigation, as you mentioned. Were you able to get access to some of the people who were on the inside of this?
Oh, very much so, but only after they closed up shop. The book, I mean, one of the things I think is most interesting about the book, I found it in writing it, and I think people are finding it in reading it, is that it goes behind the scenes in the Mueller investigation, and it tells people what they, you know, how they went about their work, who they are, who the people who conducted the investigation, other than Mueller himself, were largely unknown, and to the public, and that behind the scenes story is I think one of the main reasons that I wrote the book, and I think one of the main reasons to read it.
And I'm assuming that you must have made a run at getting Robert Mueller on the record. What did he say, or how did that process go?
Well, he didn't talk to me. I don't want to, you know, mislead people.
Sure.
I spoke to quite a few people in his office. I have to assume that I know that they got his permission to talk to me. And I have every reason to believe that, you know, they characterized his thought processes and his work accurately, but I don't want to give the impression that I interviewed Mueller, because I didn't.
And of the people that you did talk to on his team, how many would you describe as angry Democrats?
Well, I mean,
or 13 or 18. They never really kind of cleared that up.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. I was always confused about the 13 versus 18.
Yeah.
Trump went back and forth on that. I mean, it's easy to make fun of the angry Democrats business, but it is also true that when you have a special counsel investigation, it does tend to attract people who were politically unsympathetic to the president. And it's one of the problems, frankly, with special counsel, independent counsel. I know this from personal experience, in part because, you know, I wrote about the Starr investigation. I wrote an article for The New Yorker about the political activism of some of the people on Starr's staff, including Starr himself. I was on the staff of Lawrence Walsh in the independent counsel investigation of Iran-Contra. And that staff was not full of Reagan supporters, I can say with confidence. Now, does that mean they did something untoward or investigated him, this case, in some different way? I think far more significant was the fact that Mueller chose all veteran prosecutors, people who had experience and had the values of the Department of Justice. But, you know, I know the Clinton people felt threatened by the fact that there were so many people with clear partisan Republican sympathies on the Starr staff. And, you know, I don't think, as I say, it affected the outcome of the investigation, but it's not a trivial issue.
Right. But with a special counsel investigation, when you're choosing your staff, you're not even allowed to ask what someone's politics are or if they've ever donated to a Democrat or Republican. So how do you really
exactly
know?
And yeah. And, you know, you are drawing from a pool of lawyers basically in Washington, because that's where the investigation was based. Yeah. And most lawyers in Washington, like most people in Washington, are Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Just who these, you know, that's just how the demographics yeah. work. So it's not a surprise that you did have quite a few people who had given money to Democrats. But I don't think that really affected the outcome of the investigation.
And I've heard many people say that Mueller aged a lot during that investigation. The Robert Mueller who took the job in 2017 wasn't the same man who emerged from this probe in 2019. And of course, we saw this in his testimony before Congress. Did the people with whom you spoke say anything about the physical or mental toll that the investigation took on him?
Yes, they did. And they said it took a toll. Now, I don't, I think people can overstate the degree to which Mueller was affected by his age, but this was an incredibly grueling 2 years. Even though Mueller did not appear in public during these 2 years, the grinding pressure of this kind of seven day work weeks, you know, topped by incredible amounts of scrutiny, tremendous criticism from the President of the United States, among others. It was draining. It was tough. A lot of the other members of his staff compensated by eating. They talked about the Mueller 15. A lot of them gained
really?
Gained 15 pounds during the course of the investigation. But it is true that the Robert Mueller testified before the House of Representatives in July of 2019 was a surprising and diminished figure to many people who knew him well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a consequence mm-hmm. of the investigation.
Well, let's talk about the other side. Trump's team of lawyers, even his legal team, true to form, made for a pretty interesting cast of characters. You had Jay Sekulow, John Dowd, Rudy Giuliani, and I'm pretty sure there's one or two that I'm forgetting right now.
Oh, well, there are quite a few that you were forgetting. It was right. It was a large cast by the end. But I think you identified the three main ones.
Right.
And, you know, as I write in the book, there was a lot of similarity to the team that Trump assembled for his 2016 campaign. It was chaotic. It was driven by internal rivalries. Trump was full of criticism for them. The other thing it had in common was they won. And there was, I think, some very good lawyering done by that group, particularly Dowd, Sekulow, and Giuliani. Most importantly, in a story I tell at some length in the book, is about how they forestalled Mueller's effort to get Trump to testify, either mm-hmm. voluntarily or through a grand jury subpoena, and managed to get Mueller to settle for a written questions and answers that were largely written by two of other members of Trump's team, Jane and Marty Raskin, two Florida lawyers. And you know, they were almost uniquely uninformative because, you know, when lawyers write answers to questions, they design it so that they can't be disproven by mm-hmm. other facts. I don't mean anything untoward that the Raskins did, but that was more their work than Donald Trump's work. So Mueller really didn't get much out of those written questions and answers.
Yeah, the president's lawyers, I mean, pretty much all but admitted that they didn't want him to meet with Robert Mueller because he has this compulsive need to exaggerate and play with the truth. They basically said he can't help himself. Is it a given that he would have lied in that interview and probably dug himself in a deeper hole?
Well, I don't know. You know, one of the interesting things is that Trump has had an extremely litigious career and in the private sector, and he's given a lot of depositions. I think what he does is filibuster more than he lies. He saves his lies for Twitter and his press conferences. So I'm not sure that, you know, Trump would have lied had he been examined, but the lawyers were smart enough to know that it was a terrible risk and a needless risk. So they were going to fight every way they could to avoid it. And if Mueller had subpoenaed Trump, they certainly would have challenged it in the courts and had a multi-month battle over it. I still think it was a mistake on Mueller's part not to begin that battle, because, you know, as informative and detailed as the Mueller report is, and I think it is quite detailed, the absence of Trump's voice from it is notable and unfortunate.
Yeah. And I remember how Trump's legal team would frame a potential interview as a quote unquote perjury trap, as if Mueller was somehow trying to trick the president or trip him up. Isn't that term a misnomer? I mean, you're either lying or you're not. Can someone really fool you into perjuring yourself?
I don't really even understand what the words perjury right. trap mean. It's funny, you know, every time one of these scandals happens, there starts to be a new vocabulary that comes around. I mean, perjury trap is not a new phrase, but yeah, I mean, if you tell the truth, you can't be trapped. Yeah. Another phrase that you know, I literally had never heard before, despite a lifetime spent in the world of criminal justice, process crimes. It's like, oh, obstruction of justice is only a process crime. Well, so what? I mean, it's like it's a crime. And I don't know what a process. I mean, I know what it's used to describe, but I don't understand why it's sort of like okay to commit a process crime, but not some other kind of crime.
Right, right. And even Trump and his team's use of the word collusion. Collusion is not a legal term, at least within this context. I mean, there's coordination, I guess, or something like that.
Well, conspiracy.
Conspiracy, right.
But you know, it is... you know, I mean, one of the things that, you know, Mueller investigated at great length and did not find was some sort of meeting of the minds between Trump and any sort of Russians during the 2016 campaign, any sort of agreement, a conspiracy to commit illegal acts. The peculiar thing about it is Russia did an extraordinary effort to help Trump win this election. And one of the things I spell out in the book is just how Mueller identified, and it really is an extraordinary piece of detective work, both the Internet Research Agency through the use of social media out of St. Petersburg, and even more extensively by the Russian military intelligence in Moscow to hack the Democratic National Committee emails and later the emails of John Podesta, Clinton's campaign chair. That was an incredibly elaborate effort by Vladimir Putin's regime to help Donald Trump get elected president. Trump encouraged it, but there was no evidence, at least that Mueller found, or certainly that I found, that there was direct communication between the two or agreements between the Russians and Trump. And by that definition, and I think, you know, in fairness, you have to say it, there was no crime committed by Trump with the Russians.
And yet all of these people around him were somehow dirty. You had so many people. It's funny, as much as they wanted to portray it as a hoax, you do have a number of people who were indicted and convicted or pled guilty. And, you know, his own family were meeting with the Russians, or his campaign leaders, his national security advisor, other close associates, Roger Stone. I mean, how is it everyone around Trump is dirty, but none of it ever touches him?
Well, I mean, you know, Jim Comey, the FBI director who had these bizarre dealings with Trump before Trump fired him, said his interactions with Trump reminded him of how organized crime leaders, mafia leaders, dealt with outsiders and subordinates. They never say anything explicit, but there is a lot of understanding between the lines of what, you know, what's really going on. And Trump seems to have accomplished a lot with a wink and a nod, but you can't prosecute people with winks and nods. And I think prosecutors, quite properly, are bound only by what they can prove, and they couldn't prove that Trump and the Russians agreed to anything.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. You opened the book with a meeting at the White House between Robert Mueller and President Trump in, I believe, 2017, the only time that those two people met in person. Since that meeting, Donald Trump has pushed this narrative that Mueller came to the White House to, quote, beg for his old job. He was campaigning to replace Comey as FBI director, and because Trump turned him down, Mueller had some kind of an axe to grind, and that colored his whole investigation. Was there ever any truth to that version of the story?
No, there was no truth to it. And yes, that's why I opened the book, in part because it's such a vivid tableau of the two protagonists in the story. And they are both such distinctive characters with some things in common. I mean, they are almost exactly the same age. Mueller was born in 1942. Trump was born in 1944. Both come from wealth. Mueller's father had a high-level job at DuPont. They both went to Ivy League schools, Penn for Trump, Princeton for Mueller. But they couldn't be more different in terms of their personalities and values. As we know, Donald Trump has always been, you know, in the Donald Trump business. And Mueller has devoted his life to public service, in particular to institutions. The Marine Corps, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and his loyalty to those institutions, as is so often the case, is both his greatest strength and his greatest weakness. And I think that played out over the course of the investigation, as particularly towards the end, he placed his trust in William Barr, the Attorney General, to characterize the Mueller's findings accurately, and Barr acted like the partisan toady that he has become. And but Mueller didn't fight back. He deferred to the judgment of the Attorney General, which is what an institutionalist tends to do.
Yeah, I was interested to read that Barr actually offered to let Mueller read his statement before he issued it, and Mueller declined. If this was going to be the only public statement about an investigation that Mueller had spent almost 2 years of his life on, why would he not want to read it first?
Well, you know, that's a fascinating question and dilemma, and I spent some time on it in the book, and what the Mueller people thought. And they thought about this, although they didn't have a lot of time because, you know, Rod Rosenstein's deputy went to Aaron Zebley, who was Mueller's effective second in command, the morning of the Sunday in March 2019 when Barr was about to announce the report, and said, do you want to read the letter? And they decided, look, we don't want to have to vouch for Barr's conclusions. Barr's conclusions are Barr's conclusions. We spoke through the report itself. I think this was an act of some naivete on the part of the Mueller people, because it did not occur to them that Barr would so mischaracterize the findings and diminish their significance. In addition, the Mueller people didn't realize that it was going to be a month until the report itself was released after Barr's Sunday afternoon press conference. So for a month, the only thing the public heard was this real mischaracterization of Trump's of Mueller's findings, and that Mueller's team didn't have a sufficiently cynical and political turn of thinking that they realized they were setting themselves up for that problem.
Yeah, the picture that you paint of Mueller in this book is almost of a guy who comes from a totally different era and is a little bit lost in this new era of win at all costs, political media spin and everything. Do you think that he had too much restraint? Was he almost too honorable in the way that he went about this?
Yes, I mean, I think that that's one way of putting it. I don't think it was naivete is exactly the word. I think you know, I say at one level it's a confrontation between good and evil. More to the point is that it's a confrontation between old and new.
That
Mueller comes from the old school where he, you know, where prosecutors don't say anything, where they just speak in court and that's it. What Giuliani in particular did was he used his public platform to turn Mueller into a political partisan, and he mobilized Trump supporters against Mueller and disparaged Mueller in extraordinarily personal and misleading terms. And Mueller never said a word about it, never responded.
Right.
And I think that was indicative of how Mueller thought prosecutors should behave, but it had a cost. And I think that was a good symbol of the difference between Trump and Trump's team and Mueller's team.
Yeah, why didn't Mueller subpoena Trump?
Well, this is a big part of my book. I mean, he did want to talk to Trump, but he knew there would be a big legal fight if he did subpoena him, and he wanted to try to work it out. So that he didn't have to ask Rod Rosenstein for permission to subpoena Trump. You know, one of the important things to remember about the Mueller investigation is that he was a special counsel, that is, an employee of the Department of Justice, not an independent counsel the way Kenneth Starr was, the way Lawrence Walsh was. They both had an independent legal justification for their authority. Mueller was just part of the Department of Justice. And anytime he wanted to go outside the precise confines of what Rod Rosenstein assigned him to do, he had to go back to Rosenstein for permission. Now, Rosenstein never said no, but he also never, that was always a concern.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I think there was some very clever lawyering on the part of Dowd, Sekulow, and later Giuliani. You know, they never said no to an interview. And in fact, there was one actually tentatively scheduled for the end of January 2018 at Camp David. But John Dowd, who was then the lead lawyer, pulled the plug towards the last minute, towards the time it was going to take place. I think that's that was the moment that Mueller should have said, the hell with these negotiations, I'm just going to issue a grand jury subpoena, because then the case might have worked its way all the way through the courts by the time the Supreme Court's term ended in June of 2018. By the time, you know, the negotiations continued in the fall of 2018, Mueller really wanted to wrap things up. I mean, he did not want to be Kenneth Starr and do this investigation for 5 years. And Trump's lawyers played on that. I mean, they took advantage of Mueller's desire for relative haste, and that's why they could bet, and they did bet correctly, that Mueller wouldn't take the time for a long legal fight over his testimony once you get past the midpoint of 2018.
And I also want to ask you about probably one of the biggest mysteries about Donald Trump, which is why he has fought tooth and nail to prevent the public from ever seeing his tax returns. Why didn't the Mueller investigation or the Southern District of New York attempt to get access to his tax returns and his financial records? Why weren't those relevant to the investigation at the time?
That's a tough, tough call, and I'm critical of Mueller in some respects. But this one is one which I think it's a defensible position. You know, Trump's finances were not within the original ambit of what Rosenstein had assigned Mueller to do. So he would have had to go to Rosenstein and ask for permission to get the tax returns, to get the financial records. And it is true that there is this lingering mystery, which remains a mystery today, of why Trump has been so solicitous of Vladimir Putin, why he has so has always refused to criticize him. And, you know, does it suggest that there is some financial relationship between Trump and Russia? Or, and would that be reflected in his tax returns? That's pretty much speculation. And, you know, prosecutors don't usually work on the basis of speculation. Plus, you know, they had enough evidence to show, you know, why Trump would want Russia's aid. I mean, Russia was helping him in the 2016 election. They didn't need to show the financial side of things. But I think other prosecutors might have made a different judgment and been more aggressive about it. But this one was, I think, a very tough call.
With regard to the other issue under investigation, you say that Trump was far guiltier of the crime of obstruction than either Clinton or Nixon. And yet Mueller in his report stopped just shy of saying that the president committed the crime of obstruction. What was his thinking in hinting at a crime but not saying it explicitly?
Yeah, these are my two big criticisms of Mueller, the failure to subpoena and the way he characterized the obstruction of justice in the in his final report. I thought Mueller and his team did a brilliant job of investigating obstruction of justice. I mean, the proof and the detail, you know, I think the Mueller report itself was more purchased than read. I don't know how many people got all the way through it besides me repeatedly. But if you read the Mueller report, it is quite clear that President Trump obstructed justice far more egregiously than Bill Clinton did that got him impeached and Richard Nixon did that got him forced from office. But the idea that the Mueller team had was, under the Department of Justice policy, which many people became familiar with, the president cannot be indicted by the Justice Department while he is president. That is viewed as a forbidden under Department of Justice policy, and Mueller, as an employee of the Justice Department, was bound by it. That led Mueller to conclude, well, if I can't indict Trump, I can't give him his day in court and let him try to respond to criminal charges. So I'm not going to even say anything about whether there were grounds for a prosecution against Mueller, against Trump. And I think that was really an over-generous reading of the law, over-generous to Trump, which basically led Trump to be able to say that he was vindicated in the report when he wasn't, and then led, and Barr said the same thing. I just think it was an act of undue restraint and undue deference to the president that had enormous consequences, and I thought undermined the really great work that the office had done in proving that the president had obstructed justice. But again, that was an example of Mueller's deference to institutions, which is really a touchstone of his character.
Yeah. And since then, little by little, Bill Barr has done his damnedest to dismantle everything the Mueller investigation did. He tried to reduce Roger Stone's sentence and drop the case against Michael Flynn, even though Flynn had already pled guilty. And now he's investigating the Mueller investigation itself. There's even speculation that Barr might even be cooking up an October surprise. Let me ask you, in the long history of this Justice Department, have you ever seen an attorney general so brazenly political and cravenly beholden to the man who put him there?
I look at this both as a journalist, but also as someone who was in the Department of Justice myself. I mean, I was an assistant U.S. attorney. I was just a line prosecutor. I wasn't anything at any high level. But, you know, I do know the traditions and norms of the Department of Justice, and they are really honorable and admirable. You know, everyone knows that the Attorney General is a political appointee, but the tradition of working in, with political independence is really a strong one there. And to see Barr pervert those traditions in such egregious ways over and over again, and in ways that have really never been done before. I mean, the idea that the only defendant William Barr intervenes on behalf of to lower his sentence was Roger Stone, the president's friend. And, you know, I've asked around. I've never heard of the Department of Justice moving to overturn a conviction when the defendant has pleaded guilty. And now to order this autopsy of the Russia investigation, which, you know, Barr has all but said is going to come out before the election, is just a really shameful chapter in the Department of Justice's history. And, you know, it's all at Barr's feet.
Well, sooner or later, Trump will no longer be president, whether that's a year from now or 4 years from now, and he will no longer have the protections of that office. He will be fair game for indictment again. Do you think that there will be much of an appetite, specifically with the U.S. attorney for the Southern District, to keep pursuing Trump? I mean, realistically, could Donald Trump still one day see the inside of a jail cell?
Well, I don't think there will ever be a further federal criminal investigation of Trump. I think if Biden wins, he is not going to want to spend his political capital on a case like that. That would, of course, suck up all the oxygen in Washington. And Biden has a much more extensive legislative and agenda that doesn't include that. The wild card is the Manhattan District Attorney. Now, that is an active investigation. And the Supreme Court ruled that Cyrus Vance, who was the Manhattan DA, will be able to get access to Trump's financial records, including his tax returns. And I think that investigation is going to continue regardless of whether Trump wins. And that is an investigation under state law, not federal law. So there is nothing the Justice Department could do to forestall it. Or to stop even an indictment from coming out. I mean, it is a completely separate source of authority that state prosecutors have. Now, I don't want to assume that Vance will find evidence of criminality on the president's part. I think a lot of the president's critics are far too quick to assume that there is sort of all this evidence of criminality out there. I haven't seen it. But there might be, and I think if there is, Vance will bring those cases, regardless of whether Trump is president or not.
Well, in the last couple minutes we have left here, I do want to ask you a little about the Supreme Court. What do you make of Chief Justice Roberts' decisions in the last term? Is something going on internally with him? Is he changing? What's happening right now?
Well, I don't have access to the innermost thoughts of the Chief Justice, but, you know, as someone who's followed him very closely for a very long time, he's now been Chief Justice for 15 years, I do think he's changed. I do think that he has not quite become a never-Trumper, but I think he is someone who is worried about how Trump has trampled on the norms and in some cases the laws of how a president is supposed to behave. You know, just in the past year, you know, the Chief Justice voted to strike down the abortion laws in Louisiana, to strike down to assert that gay people can't be fired for no reason under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. You know, that the Trump administration didn't follow appropriate procedures in trying to end the protections for the Dreamers and acted appropriately in adding a citizenship question to the census. I don't believe that the John Roberts of 5 years ago or 10 years ago would have voted the same way. I can't prove that. But I do think something is going on with Roberts that, you know, shows he's certainly not become some liberal, but he is turned off by how Donald Trump has conducted his presidency.
And if there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court between November and January, is it just a given that Mitch McConnell will try to fill that seat? And would there even be enough time to get that done?
Well, you know, I've tried to research that question. And I think, you know, the fastest that could be done, basically, is about 6 to 8 weeks. And it's pretty much got to be done by the end of the year, not January 20th, because the Senate, the new Senate is sworn in at the first of the year, not when the president is sworn in on January 20th. You know, McConnell doesn't have a big margin for error. He's only got 53 Republicans. I think some Republicans would be appalled by the hypocrisy of blocking Merrick Garland's nomination, you know, 11 months before the end of Barack Obama's term, and trying to jam someone through, you know, in the last weeks of Trump's. I never bet against Mitch McConnell, though. He will do his darndest if he can, and we'll see if he can. Mm-hmm.
Well, before we go, I mentioned in the intro that I've heard that you've already sold the TV or movie rights to your latest book. Any thoughts on casting?
You know, casting is sort of like the dessert and the fun part. And I have to say it's still at a very early stage. And I leave that to the producers, but it's always fun to see who they come up with. Mm-hmm.
Well, again, the book is called True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Jeffrey Toobin, thanks for talking with me.
Terrific. Thanks. That was really fun.
Thanks again to Jeffrey Toobin for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. You can frequently find Jeffrey's astute legal analysis on CNN or in The New Yorker, and follow him on Twitter at Jeffrey Toobin. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.